the American view of the UN has been damaged by the fabrications and the distortions over the years from groups like the Heritage Foundation, for example, which have misrepresented what the UN does and what it's all about. And that has seeped into the American consciousness. And it's such an easy target, you know. If you're feeling nasty one day or grumpy, you can always lash out at the United Nations.
Former Ambassador Stephen Lewis talks about the United Nations today on Common Ground. Common Ground is a program on world affairs and the people who shape events. It's produced by the Stanley Foundation. I'm Keith Porter. Stephen Lewis has long been both an advocate and a critic of the United Nations. He served first as the ambassador of Canada to the UN and later as the Secretary General's special advisor on Africa. He now serves as an advisor to the UN's Children's Fund, UNICEF, and to the UN's upcoming Fourth World Conference on Women. He begins by explaining his role with UNICEF and his admiration for the late UNICEF executive director, James Grant.
Well, the title, and titles are absurdly misleading in the UN system, the title is a special representative of the executive director. And the former executive director, Jim Grant, was kind enough to permit me over the last 4 or 5 years to do numbers of things for UNICEF of a highly eclectic kind. They involve speaking at conferences, they involve researching certain issues as they emerge, for instance, the issue of landmines or the issue of sanctions. They involve increasingly doing seminars and training sessions on the Convention on the Rights of the Child, its meaning, implementation in many countries. It often involves sitting down with individual governments to discuss their policies on education or child health or nutrition or these range of matters. It is, as I say, a highly eclectic life, and I have valued it hugely. And because I am a consultant to UNICEF rather than an employee, it allows me the extraordinarily privileged position of being able to take strong personal stands on a number of issues in a way which doesn't reflect adversely on UNICEF, because I do it sort of in another persona. I do it just as a human being who cares about international affairs and knows a little bit about the UN system. But UNICEF has, from my point of view when I was at the UN and since, it has such a principled and uncompromising stand. It uses its resources so well. It's such a focused agency. And children can so often cross all the ideological lines. And children can so often raise resources which are otherwise not available. And children can so often be seen as a kind of engine for wider development, that it's really a privilege to be working in that field.
You mentioned James Grant, the longtime executive director that we lost just recently. Tell us something about his legacy at UNICEF.
For me, Jim Grant ranks with the Gandhis and the Martin Luther Kings of this world. I mean, just one of those astonishing and memorable human beings that you meet once in a lifetime and has a profound impact on everything he encountered. And there are very few people one knows in life of whom it can be said that he saved millions of lives, that he changed countries' whole policies towards children, that he made them all appreciate the importance of immunization and oral rehydration therapy and antibiotics and the iodizing of salt in order to prevent retardation and the availability of vitamin A in order to prevent blindness, and this extraordinary capacity to persuade everyone from, you know, kings to commoners of the legitimacy of putting children first, of first call for children. And he did it all without any self-importance. He was a guy who related to everyone comfortably. And he didn't care whether he was speaking to a group of rural mothers about breastfeeding or whether he was sitting down with a council of ministers to discuss sophisticated policies on universal primary education. It all meant the same to Jim. There were no gradations in humanity. Everyone was important. Every issue was important. So he was a lovely human being, possessed of a cause, and he made it work, and he inspired everyone around him. We were very close friends, and he was, of course, good friends with so many people. It was an unbelievable loss. But it was interesting that in all of the memorial services all over the world, it was a celebration of a life rather than some lugubrious recollection. And it was topped off in New York at St. John the Divine Cathedral when 3,000 people gathered to say goodbye, and Hillary Clinton announced that the United States would sign the Convention on the Rights of the Child in Jim's honor, which was a lovely touch.
And, yeah, you say it was a surprise, and he was on the job virtually up until the end.
Till the last moment. He got a letter from the President of the United States the day before he died, where President Clinton said, Jim, thank you for your enormous contribution to children. And Jim, who died literally 24 hours later, turned to his colleagues who were by his bedside at the time and said, this is a lovely letter from the president, but I want you to send a fax back immediately telling him that as much as I appreciate his salute for what I've done, I would feel a lot better about it if he would sign the Convention on the Rights of the Child. And sure enough, that's what happened a few weeks later, and it's not just one of those, you know, legendary stories about Jim Grant, because that's the way he was every single day of his life. He was fighting until the moment he passed out of this world.
Another American has been chosen as the successor, Carol Bellamy, the director of the Peace Corps. Can you tell us anything about her, or what about the process by which the successor was chosen?
Well, my colleagues at UNICEF New York are quite thrilled by it. I'm quite thrilled by it. This is a woman whom those who know her well say can inspire, is focused, is a manager, has vision. I mean, it sounds like the right inheritor of the legacy which Grant left. And she's had very, very considerable experience, of course, everything from controller in New York to elected public office for the Democratic Party to the Peace Corps. I mean, this is someone with a great range of interests and knowledge. So I'm very, very tickled. And she is a feminist, and she understands these issues, and she's pro-choice, which for many of us is very important in the sort of contemporary struggles. And all of this brings very great qualities to UNICEF. The process by which she was chosen, mystical, opaque, unimaginable to mere mortals. This process is a battle between countries around candidates, and the Secretary General is the ultimate arbiter. And whether he does it on the basis of careful assessment or flips a coin or gets up from bed one morning and decides, Eureka, through divine inspiration, I know who I'm going to choose. God alone knows how these things happen. But in this instance, he chose well, and that's a joy.
Good. In one UNICEF publication, I read about your involvement in the Children in War study. Can you tell us about that?
In the General Assembly of 1993, there was a resolution passed instructing the Secretary General to appoint an expert to do a study on the consequences of armed conflict on children. And after looking at all kinds of candidates and possibilities, in the middle of 94, the Secretary General appointed Grazia Machel to be that expert. Grazia Machel is the former First Lady of Mozambique. You may recall her husband, Samora Machel, the first president, died in a plane crash some years ago. And Grazia has been Minister of Education. She heads a foundation for women and children. She was a tremendous anti-apartheid activist. She's charismatic on a platform. She's bright as can be. It's a great choice. And the resolution said that helping Grazia should be UNICEF and the Center for Human Rights in Geneva in particular. Well, the center has an enormous amount of savvy, and UNICEF has the capacity to raise some money as well as having a tremendous amount of savvy and experience. So we UNICEF has thrown itself into it with resources and energy, and I think a lot of knowledge. And we're in the process of helping Graca. It is her study, it's not UNICEF's study, but we're helping to the extent she wants it and needs it as she assembles material from around the world, and the study will be tabled in the General Assembly in the fall of 96. We're holding 5 major regional consultations around the world with many countries involved and many people from the grassroots level. And we're having a number of countries visited by Graca, and we're doing 6 field studies, and we're doing 12 to 15 technical studies to attach to the report. And because it's a General Assembly resolution, Graca can be tough, unorthodox, unexpected, radical in her recommendations. She doesn't have to work in the field of anonymity.
Over the last year, the world has witnessed some horrible scenes in Rwanda, and it looks like we may be facing something similar in Burundi now. What's UNICEF's role been in mitigating those disasters?
UNICEF has, as an agency, plunged into the vortex, into the inferno, to deliver food, to deliver medical supplies, to protect the orphaned children, to follow the children who are internally displaced but are not refugees by modern definition. That is, they haven't always crossed borders, but they're still locked in their own country without parents who died, etc. UNICEF has been on the ground nonstop from the beginning, attempting to salvage what one can salvage of young lives, of infant lives, in such desperate circumstances. But much more than UNICEF and the activities of the United Nations High Commission on Refugees and many of the wonderful NGOs, you know, Oxfam and Save the Children and Catholic Relief and Lutheran Relief and endless international non-governmental organizations from World Vision to Médecins Sans Frontières. What's needed far more than that is the United Nations getting its act together to be able to intervene militarily when a state is falling apart in order to save its people. I mean, the horrible scenes of Rwanda, which are etched in the mind, are scenes of the genocide, of the killing of 500,000 people while the entire world looked on and did nothing. And these weren't people killing themselves with sophisticated modern weaponry. This was with machetes. I mean, it would have been possible with a strong UN force to save hundreds of thousands of lives, and yet the world community and the UN itself was somehow immobilized. Well, that, of course, is unconscionable. It mustn't be allowed ever to happen again. And that's why, even though UNICEF's role is exemplary, it rushes in and it tries to rescue. What has to be done is to prevent it from happening in the first place, and that's the UN's role.
We're talking in this edition of Common Ground with former United Nations Ambassador Stephen Lewis. Printed transcripts and audio cassettes of this program are available from Journal Graphics. Listen at the end of the broadcast for details. Common Ground is a service of the Stanley Foundation, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that conducts a wide range of programs meant to provoke thought and encourage dialogue on world affairs. In the U.S., there's this debate about the usefulness of the U.N., and I noticed in some pictures, I think in another UNICEF publication, there's pictures of scenes from Rwanda, and in one of them there were tents that had been made out of canvas, and the United Nations High Commission on Refugee insignia was all over that, and some water tanks that had the UNICEF symbol on them, and I thought, you know, those people being served there probably don't doubt the usefulness of the United Nations, or at least of those agencies. Do you recognize different perceptions of the U.N. as you view the work of the UN around the world?
Absolutely, but it's necessary for me to say that the negative perception is confined in its extremes to the United States. It is not a perception which is shared in the rest of the Western world. It is certainly not a perception which is shared in the developing world, which understands the importance of the UN and has so often benefited from it. In my country, Canada, there's no country closer to the United States than Canada. In my country, Canada, while we understand that the UN has deficiencies and liabilities and it hasn't always worked as we would want it to work, there is tremendous support for the organization because we know we have to have an international institution. We know we have to have an international agency. And unlike the Republicans in the American Congress, the right wing of Canadian political life, and we have a very strong right wing as well, is not isolationist, is not absurdly Pavlovian, knocking the UN whenever it gets the chance. It may be more critical than the center or the left, but it also has real regard for what the UN has done and can do. There's something terribly mindless about the American criticism. It's not criticism which is rooted in any real understanding. I'm sorry to put it that way and to speak of it in that fashion. But the American view of the UN has been damaged by the fabrications and the distortions over the years from groups like the Heritage Foundation, for example, which have misrepresented what the UN does and what it's all about. And that has seeped into the American consciousness. And it's such an easy target, you know. If you're feeling nasty one day or grumpy, you can always lash out at the United Nations. That doesn't happen in Europe. It doesn't happen amongst the Nordic countries. It doesn't happen in Australia, New Zealand. It doesn't happen in Canada. There the criticisms exist. I want to emphasize that. Tough criticisms. Whenever I speak, I can be very tough on the UN. But it's not mindless and it's not brutal and it's not silly and it's not irrelevant. At least I don't think it is. It recognizes limitations, but it also recognizes strengths. In the United States, the perceptions are often so negative without acknowledging the strengths. And that, I think, is a mistake because the UN has been very valuable to the U.S.
What would you see as the long-term implications of a slide in U.S. support for the U.N.?
A great damage to the U.N., real damage to the U.N., not only financially, which is the way it's first felt, but morally and politically. Because without the support of the United States, no international organization can really function well. You can't have the most important country in the world giving you the back of the hand and expect to have the integrity and the reputation sufficient. So I hope over time, over the next few years, the United States will have less or fewer angry impulses towards the United Nations.
All right, another area for you. 3 years ago, Secretary General Boutros-Ghali promised comprehensive reform of the United Nations, and now we sit here at the 50th anniversary. How have the comprehensive reforms gone?
Well, there haven't been comprehensive reforms, but there has been. He unleashed an extraordinary discussion. He put out a monograph called Agenda for Peace, which stimulated a discussion about peacekeeping, peacemaking, use of force, intervention, sovereignty. What is the role of the United Nations in this new post-Cold War period? He has more recently issued something called Agenda for Development, which takes a hard look at the socioeconomic side of the United Nations, including environment and poverty and population and all of those elements. I've never seen the UN more vigorously engaged in self-analysis, self-criticism, a look at potential alternative recommendations. There are more reports per capita than I've ever seen in my life emerging, some of them absolutely splendid documents about how the UN might be reformed, from institutional reforms like expanding the Security Council to much more fundamental reforms like establishing a vehicle to enter countries that are falling apart through a voluntary UN force or a standing force, redefining the role of the UN, and even challenging the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund over who should control international economic and financial decisions. So there is in the atmosphere, and there is in the international vocabulary, a completely new view of UN reform. Boutros-Ghali has been successful in getting this process going. It'll be interesting to see at the end of 1995 in the General Assembly session in the fall whether some of the reforms are actually implemented and whether the charter is actually amended to facilitate them.
How do you see the sides lining up on that? I mean, is there a clear division among people who are mostly in favor or mostly opposed?
No, actually, it's really interesting. Everybody wants reform. Absolutely everyone. So if there are sides, it's a question of who values what most. Japan and Germany are interested most in Security Council reform because they want to be on the Security Council. The developing countries are much more interested in establishing, for example, an economic Security Council, dealing solely with development issues because they think it will benefit them. You'll notice that at the G7 meeting in my country, in Halifax, they are discussing the role of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. This is really unexpected. 50 years after those financial institutions were created, even the major Western governments are sufficiently discombobulated about the performance and the behavior of the bank and the fund that they want to re-examine it. So everywhere you turn, each of the groupings has its own agenda, but it all amounts to an agenda for reform.
Talk about two of those reforms. First, the Security Council expansion one. Any prediction on that? Do you think we'll really see expansion? And if so, will it make a difference?
I'm not sure that it will make a difference, although I think logic says that now that there are 184 countries or 185 countries in the UN, one should have a Security Council of slightly larger than 15. And the suggestion everywhere is 23. And there is a feeling that there should be some additional permanent members, like Germany and or Japan, like Pakistan or India, like Brazil or Argentina, like Nigeria or South Africa, and some rotating members. No one is suggesting giving additional veto power to any of the new adherents. It's really a sort of logic that's compelling it. We had 15 when there were just over 100 countries in the UN. Now there are practically 200. Surely we should expand the Security Council to be more representative.
And the other question is on the coordination, or whatever you want to call it, between the United Nations and the Bretton Woods institutions. Will something happen there, do you think?
Well, if the United Nations can't get its act together where the World Bank and the IMF are concerned, then we will never have the eradication of poverty. We will never have the bridging of the gulf between the North and the South. We will never have serious international economic and financial planning. So everybody understands that the Bretton Woods and the UN must now start working together. You know, in theory at least, the Bretton Woods institutions, the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, are part of the international UN system. It's just that they've thumbed their noses at the rest of the system because they have all the money and therefore they have all the power and authority. But I think the views now are that enough is enough, that they've had too much autonomy, that they've wreaked havoc in many, many parts of the developing world, and it's time to call them to account. And therefore, before the year 2000, you'll see a much closer working relationship.
All right, one final area. You have a special role to play in the preparations for the Fourth World Conference on Women in Beijing. Tell us about your role in that.
I'm a member of the advisory group which advises the Secretary General on the policies and activities leading up to and at Beijing. It's a thoroughly fascinating group. For me, it was my first adventure in royalty. I mean, Queen Fabiola's on the group, and Princess Basma's on the group, and Baroness Shirley Williams is on the group. I mean, I sit there with my little heart palpitating in the presence of auspicious people. It's a totally excellent group, very, very tough on women's issues, very determined. In fact, it's a feminist group, essentially, if I can use the word in its best sense. And it is a group which is very tough on the UN system and on wanting to reform the system and the way in which gender is treated. The UN only recently discovered there are two genders in the world. So it's rather important to impress upon the powers that be that the struggle for women's empowerment within all of the UN agencies has to be achieved in order for the UN to be an example to the rest of the world and get countries to change their policies. But I like the advisory group, and I'm not sure ultimately what difference it will make or what influence it will have, although I think it has already had some influence in the pressure to have a very senior woman in the Secretary General's office with a significant staff, maybe located somewhere else, but at least to follow up the implementation of Beijing as it affects the UN system. The discussions are lively, good, intrepid. Nobody's intimidated. It's worth doing.
There have been such high expectations for this conference, and yet now we find ourselves in a rather precarious point in preparations for this. Tell us about what has happened.
Very briefly, the government of China arbitrarily moved the site for the NGO forum, which means that the 20 or 30,000 women who were expected to be in Beijing representing all kinds of organizations at the grassroots around the world will be isolated in a site on the nether side of the airport, an hour and a half to 2 hours away from the main conference center where the governments are meeting, which is a violation of all the previous conferences and the way in which the UN works with non-governmental organizations. China has to be made to change its mind. Secondly, there is a counterattack on the women's rights which have already been achieved and have already been endorsed by the international community at the Cairo Conference on Population and at the Vienna Conference on Human Rights. There is an effort on the part of the Holy See, in conjunction with a handful of countries, mainly Catholic countries, plus some Islamic countries like Iran and others. There is an attack on the language and the achievements and the progress of previous documents as though they're going to stop women's equality. They're determined to take a stand and turn back the struggle for equality. They won't succeed. And it's a very bitter pill for the women's movement to have to swallow, to see that these male-led attacks didn't show themselves when we were debating poverty or population or development or environment or children. They only show themselves when we're debating the rights of women. It's really objectionable. It's really morally objectionable. And they will not prevail. The women's movement will prevail because the struggle for gender equality is probably the single most important struggle in the world today. But it is a struggle. It is really a struggle. Men, you know, are beyond redemption as a species.
That is former UN Ambassador Stephen Lewis. For Common Ground, I'm Keith Porter. For a printed transcript or an audio cassette of this program, please send $5 per transcript or $11.70 per cassette to Common Ground, show number 9524, Journal Graphics, 1535 Grant Street, Denver, Colorado, 80203. Again, ask for program number 9524. To order by credit card, call toll-free 1-800-825-5746. If you'd like more information about the Stanley Foundation or you have some comment about the program, please write to us at 216 Sycamore Street, Muscatine, Iowa, 52761. Again, the toll-free number to order cassettes or transcripts is 1-800-825-5746. Our theme music was created by B.J. Lederman. Common Ground was produced and funded by the Stanley Foundation.